what they're saying there. I can't figure that. Other than food, glorious food, I don't know what they're saying. I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books on food, everything from your favorite cookbooks to Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham. I know nobody brought that, but I'm going to say it. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, is with us, and Kelly Porter from the Woods Hole Library. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Boy, we have a pile of books here today. This was a tough assignment for you, huh?
This was one of the toughest. Every time I think we've already had the toughest assignment, then we get something like food. And food is everywhere. Everyone has a favorite book about food, a favorite cookbook, a favorite writer, a favorite novel, a favorite children's book. And by the time I was done, I must have had 80 books sitting in front of me. I was like, this is not going to work. Somehow this has to be culled. And as we do every month, we manage to cull them. But it was a really interesting and intricate kind of approach. Because everyone eats. And everyone has something to say about what they eat,
right,
from your first child's book to, you know, to right now. There are micro histories. There are all kinds of mysteries that are based on food. Everything has some food component. There is a lot of discussion about what's good food and what's bad food. So it was a very hard topic, harder than I expected.
Okay. So what did you bring for your first book then?
Well, I have
That's
to start.
Another
I have to start.
Where do we start?
Where do we start? And in this case, I believe I have the perfect food poem to start the day. A short food poem. It's from a book called The Popcorn Astronauts and Other Biteable Rhymes by Deborah Ruddle and illustrated by Joan Rankin. And it is called Menu for a Gray Day, given that we're having sort of a gray day today. A cantaloupe for breakfast with a slice of tangerine, an apricot for dinner, and a carrot in between. A nibble of a mango when you feel the time is right, and a bite of orange sherbet in the middle of the night.
All orange foods. So
that's exactly a menu for a gray day.
Oh.
So
okay,
to brighten up your day. But this book also has some fabulous other poems in it. That one seemed particularly pertinent to today. But here is another short one, which is called How a Poet Orders a Shake. A frosty cup of moonlight, please, the poet murmurs low, as mushy as a mittenful of slightly melted snow, and softer than a summer cloud, and paler than a swan, and pearlier than polar bears, the poet rambles on. And let it be at least as sweet as icing on a cake. In other words, my usual, a small vanilla shake. Anyway, very fun
Cute.
Poems all about food called The Popcorn Astronauts and Other Biteable Rhymes by Deborah Ruddle.
All right, Kelly, where are you starting?
I guess I'm going to start with one of my favorite cookbook authors of the moment, who is Melissa Clark. And she has a lot of cookbooks out right now. But the one that just sort of leapt off the shelf at me was, it's called Dinner in an Instant. And it's 75 modern recipes for your pressure cooker, multi-cooker, and instant pot. And I have definitely jumped on the instant pot bandwagon, which is...
Okay, stop. What is an instant pot?
I was just going to tell you. So it's an electric pressure cooker.
Okay.
But it can do slow cooking and a lot of different things like yogurt making.
Wow.
And it's just a really amazing functional device. And if you're like a busy working parent like I am, mm-hmm, it's quite helpful. And so this cookbook, it's really nice because if you don't happen to have an Instant Pot, it has directions for slow cooking all of these things. And it has some really good basics like making yogurt, which I've done from this cookbook, and it's delicious.
Mm.
And then some really wonderful comfort food for the fall and for days like today. And Melissa Clark has also written, she's got another one called Dinner, Changing the Game, that has just a lot of really great basic recipes. She does a lot in the New York Times right now.
Mm.
She's just an all-around wonderful cookbook author. So
now with this Instant Pot thing, is it like a slow cooker?
You
start it when you go to work and come home and it's done, or no?
So you can use it like a slow cooker like that, but it's also, so the pressure cooker... For example, I can put dried black beans in it, and you set it for 18 minutes, and they're done.
Wow.
So it can save time for things like that. And in that case, you would want to be there. Right. But it's unlike the old stovetop pressure cookers, you know, there's new safeguards and you don't have to worry about it exploding all over your kitchen.
Mm. Which is a good thing.
Yes, yeah. It's a very good thing. Wow. So this is
okay, and that's dinner, called Dinner in an Instant.
Dinner in an Instant.
Okay. Well, and I also brought a slow cooker book. This one is called Adventures in Slow Cooking, Weeknight Dinners, Party Food, Desserts, Cocktails, and More. And it's by Sarah DiGregorio.
Cocktails.
I know. That caught my attention as well. Sarah DiGregorio actually graduated from Falmouth High School. And her mother at one point, as a disclaimer, was a librarian at the Falmouth Public Library. But yes, cocktails are part of what's in here. She has warm cocktails, 8 ideas, which include Swedish spiced white wine with almonds, Mexican style hot chocolate, warm triple citrus bourbon punch. I mean, there's a little bit of something for everyone. And as she writes, I love a warm cocktail in the wintertime, but when you keep a pot of spiced wine going on the stovetop, it's hard to keep the heat low enough so that the drink doesn't taste overly cooked and reduced. Also, alcohol burns off at about 170 Fahrenheit, so if there's booze in that simmering pot, it's lost its potency. The solution? Serve a cocktail in a slow cooker set on warm. It's the perfect temperature for sipping and for maintaining the alcohol's pop. In the unlikely event of leftovers, all these cocktails keep well in the fridge for at least a week and can also be served chilled.
Wow.
So things you never knew you could do with a slow cooker. She also has a lovely introduction talking about how her grandmother used to use a slow cooker, basically, and that memory of her grandmother and her family using that is part of the reason she got so interested in slow cooking. And she also has a big section on how to buy a slow cooking cooker if you're interested in doing that, and a really fascinating history to the birth of the slow cooker, which, believe it or not, began in the story of the slow cooker begins in a small Lithuanian village in the mid-1800s. Huh. To hear the whole story, you can read her book, which is Adventures in Slow Cooking by Sarah DiGregorio, and some great weeknight dinners, again, where you can sort of put things in. But she also encourages you to be creative with your slow cooker. So it's both for sort of the basic slow cooking and those that are more adventurous with their slow cooker.
And if you have books that relate to food you'd like to add to our list this morning, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Kelly?
All right. Well, I grew up reading all the Little House on the Prairie books, and all of them have fabulous food in them. But the one that really sticks out and makes me very hungry when I read it is Farmer Boy. And this goes through the life of Almanzo, who later became Laura's husband, and follows him through his childhood. And just all throughout, there's just descriptions of all of the food that mostly his mother would prepare, but also just, you know, if he's out working all day long, these kids are hungry and they ate a lot. So there's just like this one section he describes his mother cooking donuts, and it's just so vivid and wonderful. He says, all day long mother had been baking, and when Almanzo went into the kitchen for the milk pails, she was still frying donuts. The place was full of their hot brown smell and the weedy smell of new bread, the spicy smell of cakes, and the syrupy smell of pies.
You're making me want a donut.
Oh my gosh. Every time I read this book, I just get so hungry. And there's just, throughout the entire thing, just delicious descriptions of food and how they made it as well.
The donuts part remind me of a book that I almost brought and did not bring, but I just reread the chapter. Homer Price by Robert McCloskey has this incredible chapter about donuts, where Homer is sort of put in charge of making donuts and can't essentially get the donut maker to stop. So there are hundreds and great illustrations by McCloskey, hundreds and hundreds of donuts everywhere. And then the rich woman who started to make the donuts for them, her ring is lost in one of the donuts. Uh-oh. So they have to eat all the donuts to find the ring. But what a great story. And those great McCloskey illustrations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love in this one, too. It says, some women made a newfangled shape, round with a hole in the middle. But round donuts wouldn't turn themselves over because his mother would make the longer ones. Right. And so it like was just crawlers. All of, yeah. I just love the idea of like the newfangled
new
donut.
Yeah. There's always a new thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Speaking of children's books, I brought another one, which is from my childhood and is still one of my favorite books. It's called Scrambled Egg Super by Dr. Seuss, a book that a lot of people don't seem to know about.
I did not know about this.
The Green Eggs and Ham, mm-hmm.
yes,
but not Scrambled Egg Super, but it is so much fun.
Falling
it is falling apart.
Apart.
May I just say it is falling apart. And
you've read that one a lot.
I did read this a lot. And it begins, "I don't like to brag and I don't like to boast," said Peter T. Hooper. "But speaking of toast and speaking of kitchens and ketchup and cake and kettle and stoves and the stuff people bake, well, I don't like to brag, but I'm telling you, Liz, that speaking of cooks, I'm the best that there is. Why, only last Tuesday when Mother was out, I really cooked something worth talking about." And actually, one of sort of the interesting things about this is it is a boy, in fact, who's doing all the cooking in this and talking to the person who seems to be his sister. And he goes on great voyages to find all the eggs he can of all kinds of creatures in order to make his scrambled egg super. And here's a little bit about one of the birds he finds. "To make the best scramble that's ever been made, a cook has to hook the best eggs ever laid. So I drove to the country quite rather far out, and I studied the birds that were flitting about. I looked with great care at a mop-noodled finch. I looked at a beagle-beaked, bald-headed grinch. And also I looked at a shade-roosting quail who was roosting right under a lassalax tail. And I looked at a spritz and a flannel-winged jay. But I just didn't stop. I kept right on my way, because they didn't have eggs. They weren't laying that day." So it's just the silliest. And at the end, he has created this incredible thing with all of these eggs. I also think that is a mention of the Grinch before the Grinch we know who stole Christmas. And so he, in the end, has a kitchen that is packed full of eggs. And there's this double spread illustration of eggs all over the kitchen and pots all over the kitchen. And they're all piled up high. And he's sort of running through the eggs. It is a very fun book, and it is called Scrambled Egg Super by Dr. Seuss.
I'm going to put Green Eggs and Ham on the list, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That one we know. Kelly?
So I brought Anthony Bourdain's book, Kitchen Confidential. He has written a lot of books as well, including fiction. We have a mystery by him on the shelves at the Woods Hole Public Library. But this was, I think, sort of his breakout book that came out in 2000. And it went into like the seedy underbelly of restaurant kitchens. And at the time, I think it was very eye-opening to people that, oh, that's what goes on behind the doors in the kitchen. And it really, I think, coincided with, you know, chefs becoming these sort of like rock star personalities. And, you know, there's a lot of bad behavior in this book, so it made for just a very titillating read. So that's interesting. But then I think when I was looking up information about this book, I found out that late in his life, Anthony Bourdain kind of reevaluated this book sort of in light of like the Me Too movement and sort of those changing ideas, and sort of felt bad about, you know, glamorizing that kind of behavior. And so I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Like, it doesn't necessarily discount this book as something that's interesting to read, but I like that he
acknowledged the world had changed.
Right. And he looked back at his work with a critical eye and sort of said, you know, that's maybe not such a thing to aspire to anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of interesting that he evolved as a writer and as a personality. And so this kind of lets you see where he started out.
Mm-hmm. Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you have some books that are about food that you'd like to add to our list. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on food with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Kelly Porter from the Woods Hole Public Library. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And don't worry, if you're not able to write down these titles fast enough, we will have a link to all of the books we talk about this morning a little bit later on our website. Jill?
Well, I brought along a novel because there's a lot of good food in novels. And this one I would not have expected, but somebody told me, oh, yes, you have to look at it more closely. And the novel is Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, which was a Booker Prize winning tale of Henry VIII's court, seen through the eyes of his advisor, Thomas Cromwell. But indeed, in the long cast of characters, one of them is Thurston the cook. And it's really fascinating to see the little bits of history, kitchen history, that you get in this book. So, for example, here's a little bit from one of the episodes involving Thurston. He has counted the provisions carts rolling in. He has seen kitchens thrown into turmoil, and he himself has been down in the gray-green hour before dawn when the brick ovens are swabbed out ready for the first batch of loaves, as carcasses are spitted, pots set on trivets, poultry plucked and jointed. His uncle was a cook to an archbishop, and as a child he hung about the Lambeth Palace kitchens. He knows this business inside out, and nothing about the king's comfort must be left to chance. And there's this other section talking about the kitchen and everything that he's making for people. He has the kitchen make beef olives for the cardinal, stuffed with sage and marjoram, neatly trussed and placed side by side in trays, so that the cooks at Richmond need do nothing but bake them. Show me where it says in the Bible, a man shall not eat beef olives in March. He thinks of Lady Anne, her unslaked appetite for a fight, the sad ladies about her. He sends those ladies some flat baskets of small tarts made of preserved oranges and honey. To Anne herself, he sends a dish of almond cream. It is flavored with rose water and decorated with the preserved petals of roses and with candied violets. He is above riding across the country carrying food himself, but not that much above it. It's not so many years since the Frescobaldi kitchen in Florence. Or perhaps it is, but his memory is clear, exact. He was clarifying calf's foot jelly, chatting away in his mixture of French, Tuscan, and Putney, when somebody shouted, Tommaso, they want you upstairs. And thus he ends up being a cook. But you wouldn't expect necessarily that is, but of course it's also one of the things that makes it such a great novel, that sort of depth of detail. And there is more. There's another whole section in here about spiced wafers and the making of wafers, which is fabulous. So if you want a little good food reading along with your historical fiction, Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel.
All right, Kelly?
So I brought The Art of Eating by M.F.K. Fisher. She is one of the, I would think, seminal writers writing about food and her experience of food. This particular volume includes, I think, five different of her works that she published between 1937 and 1949. She wrote over 30 books, but these are her most well-known things on food writing. And I particularly liked in the foreword to The Gastronomical Me, she writes, people ask me, why do you write about food and eating and drinking? Why don't you write about the struggle for power and security and about love the way others do? They ask it accusingly, as if I were somehow gross, unfaithful to the honor of my craft. The easiest answer is to say that, like most other humans, I am hungry. And she goes on to say that, you know, really food writing is getting to sort of the basic human condition, and that it's not just food. It's, you know, it's about all of this desire, love, yearning, our relationship to the earth. It just, I think that's why there's so much written about food, is because it's just applicable to every stage of life. And then when I was looking up just information about her, I found out, too, she had founded the Napa Valley Wine Library, which has a whole bunch of information about viniculture and Sounds like a fascinating place to visit. We might have to take a field trip. but this, her writing is just, it's really accessible and wonderful and poetic. And
She is one of the greats. And she actually also, as it happens, wrote the intro to the next book I'm going to mention. So thank you for the segue.
Yeah.
The Alice B. Toklas Cookbook, with a foreword by M.F.K. Fisher. And Alice B. Toklas, as many of you may know, was the companion of Gertrude Stein. And her cookbook was first published in 1954. And as it said in this article that was written for the Smithsonian, because they were doing an exhibit, moves beyond being a simple collection of recipes. The author pairs food with the people and events that highlight her life. She recounts her childhood and formative culinary experiences by way of foods prepared by her mother's cook, who is remembered through fritters and ice cream, dinners with artists, including an anecdote about serving bass to Picasso, and their adventures trying to continue their habit of eating well, even during wartime, are vividly recounted. Now, one of the reasons this book is known at all and is still in print is because of one particular recipe in here, which was for hashish fudge. And when it was published in America, the American censors thought, no, this is the, and here we are in Banned Books Week. So this is also a good reason to talk about this book. However, the hashish fudge recipe is now back in here, and it's sort of funny, actually. And it starts, the parentheses under the recipe title is, which anyone could whip up on a rainy day. I'm not suggesting anything, but Alice is. And she writes, this is the food of paradise, of Baudelaire's artificial paradises. This is actually very fun. It might provide an entertaining refreshment for a ladies' bridge club.
Oh, my goodness.
Or a chapter meeting of the DAR. In Morocco, it is thought to be good for warding off the common cold in damp winter weather and is indeed more effective if taken with large quantities of hot mint tea. Euphoria and brilliant storms of laughter, ecstatic reveries, and extensions of one's personality on several simultaneous planes are to be complacently expected. Almost anything St. Teresa did, you can do better if you can bear it to be ravished by an évanouissement rivière. Take 1 teaspoon black peppercorns, and then she goes on to do the actual recipe. At the end of the recipe, she does write, obtaining the cannabis may present certain difficulties, but the variety known as cannabis sativa grows as a common weed, often unrecognized everywhere in Europe, Asia, and parts of Africa, besides being cultivated as a crop for the manufacture of rope. In the Americas, while often discouraged, its cousin, called cannabis indica, has been observed even in city window boxes. It should be picked and dried as soon as it has gone to seed and while the plant is still green. So you just never know what kind of recipe you're going to find when you pick up a cookbook. Yeah. This is from the Alice B. Toklas Cookbook with a foreword by M.F.K. Fisher.
Now, have either of you read any of Philip Craig's books?
I have, but not for a long time.
A long time, yeah. And well, he always has the recipes, and it's amazing. I mean, people really look forward to, I mean, they're, you know, mysteries, but his character is Jackson, was it? J.W. Jackson. And then he did put together a book of...
Did he put a cookbook?
J.W. Jackson's recipes, and the book was called Delish, the J.W. Jackson recipes. So if you want to find all those lovely recipes that...
For those of you that haven't read his mysteries, pick them up because they're wonderful. And I remember my mother was just devastated when he died.
Yeah.
And he was like, more. He seems to actually be an author who has remained not writing, even though he's dead.
Yeah, and he wrote a lot of books. So
you've got lots to choose from.
Absolutely. All right, Kelly.
Well, it's getting colder, so ice cream season is ending for some, but one might argue.
I was like, the ice cream season continues.
Well, so I brought Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home by Jenny Britton Bauer, and this is one of my favorite ice cream books, and she helpfully has it arranged by season, so you can go right to the autumn section and make things like maple ice cream with salty buttered nuts, and roasted pumpkin five spice ice cream, which sounds like something right off the shelf of Trader Joe's. It's pumpkin season. But my particular favorite in this cookbook is her sweet corn and black raspberry ice cream, which I make almost every August. And I always tell people about it. And their first reaction is, oh, corn ice cream. But the problem with this is I make it and it makes about a quart and then it disappears really quickly at my house and then I can't bring it to people to share to make them converts to the deliciousness that is corn ice cream. So I encourage everybody to look up this book and just make it for yourself. It's called Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home.
We have an email from Henry and Jane that says, Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, has chapters on the development of food production. The librarians may know about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's another one to add to our list.
That sounds great. Yeah. Thanks. Good. Well, I'm going to go on to this phenomena that I do not clearly understand, but perhaps one of our listeners understands it better than I, which is the food mystery. And it is, you were mentioning Philip Craig. Well, people have taken it beyond Philip Craig. There is an author, for example, called Joanne Fluke. Her first food mystery was called Chocolate Chip Cookie Murder. She has just printed another book, which has just come out, called Christmas Cake Murder. And in between the Chocolate Chip Cookie Murder and the Christmas Cake Murder, there have been, let me see here, I don't know, 23 food mysteries, all which include recipes of some sort. The first one, the description of the plot is Hannah Swenson, owner of the Cookie Jar in Edenton, Minnesota, is drafted by her brother-in-law, Deputy Sheriff Bill, to help him chase down the murderer of a delivery truck driver found shot dead in the alley behind her shop. The next one is Strawberry Shortcake Murder. Hannah Held, head judge of the first annual Heartland Flower Dessert Bake Off, gets involved in a murder investigation with one of the judges. High school basketball coach Boyd Watson is found face down in Hannah's strawberry shortcake. Now, I would like to know how there can be this many murders associated with the bakery,
right?
With her bakery, and people are still buying food there. I think it's just astonishing. And the Christmas Cake Murder, which is the new one, Hannah, home for her father's funeral, visits Essie Granger in the hospital, discovers a set of notebooks in which Essie wrote a mystery novel. She is unaware that the tale is based on real events and that everything is poised to come to a head soon. So I think it's really fascinating. And she's not the only one. I mean, I think Joanne Fluke is one of the biggest ones, but right. There are lots and lots of mysteries with recipes.
Interesting.
And I don't entirely understand
the cozy connection.
Yeah,
genre.
It's the cozy mystery.
I was just thinking as you were saying it, you don't want to hang around with Miss Marple either.
Well, yeah, I like Miss Marple.
I do too, but I mean,
yes.
You know.
Right, given how many
murders. There's going to be trouble.
Right,
yeah.
Yes, this is true.
Kelly?
All right, well, so I'm going to switch gears to some fiction here, and I brought The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake by Amy Bender.
Oh, that's a great title.
I love Amy Bender. She is delightfully weird, but keeps it just a little off, but still accessible. In this particular book, it's about a girl who's on the eve of her 9th birthday. She realizes that when she tastes food, she can taste whoever made it, she can taste their emotions. And so she tastes a lemon cake that her mother makes her and realizes that her mother is a much more complicated individual than she thought. And so it's sort of like a coming of age story in a way, but then along with this, you know, kind of strange construct that she can taste emotions. And it's just, her writing is really wonderful. And I love the idea that, you know, whatever you're feeling as you're making something, that goes into your food somehow.
Well, they say baked with love, right?
Right. Okay. That's
although,
kind of just takes
although
it a step.
This mom is baking with sadness.
Yeah, her mom's got some things going on, and she, you know, she becomes in a way a detective, and then eating becomes very problematic for her because, of course, everything that she eats, it's not just about the food anymore, and so it's kind of like a Midas touch kind of problem. It's really a really great read. The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake by Amy Bender.
Well, I brought along a collection of stories called Stories from the Kitchen. It's published by Everyman's Pocket Classics. And I could bring this along because then I didn't have to bring this whole pile of books that I would have brought along because of all the people that are mentioned in here. This is a great collection. But it's for any of them, you really need to read the whole novel. A lot of these are excerpts from novels, but it includes MFK Fisher, of course, Nora Ephron, who did that wonderful novel Heartburn. If you've seen the film and loved it, you should read the book. And it also has in here Virginia Woolf from To the Lighthouse. Proust, may I say Proust, from Swan's
Who?
Way. Who's that?
I don't think Jill's ever read him.
There are so many great. Emile Zola is in here for his book, The Belly of Paris. But just listen to the opening of Heartburn by Nora Ephron, because it's so great. The beginning. I have friends who begin with pasta and friends who begin with rice. But whenever I fall in love, I begin with potatoes. Sometimes meat and potatoes and sometimes fish and potatoes, but always potatoes. I have made a lot of mistakes falling in love and regretted most of them, but never the potatoes that went with them.
That's funny.
It's just, she's such a delightful writer and it's a great novel. But this collection, again, gives you a taste, as it were, of various authors writing about food. It's Stories from the Kitchen. It's a really lovely collection edited by Diana Secker Tesdell. She's done a great job, and I think you'll find lots of other books having to do with food. Alice B. Toklas' cookbook is also in here, a bit of it. And the wonderful The Debts to Pleasure by John Lanchester is also in here. So really, pick it up. It's called Stories from the Kitchen, and you will be inspired to read more food books.
866-999-4626 is our number to add your suggestions for our list of books on food. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on food with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Kelly Porter from the Woods Hole Public Library. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. The email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Marcia is calling from Truro. Hi, Marcia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have five different books to
recommend. Oh, boy.
The first one is Chocolat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't stop eating Godiva's when I was one, Lily Pryor, P-R-I-O-I-R, called La Cucina, A Novel of Rapture. Fabulous. Mm-hmm. And En Rue Tatin, Living and Cooking in a French Town by Susan Ehrman Loomis, L-O-O-M-I-S. Again, very good French recipes. And then all the books by Laurie Calwin.
Oh, yes.
Oh, in unison, you got them both, yeah.
Did you bring those? I actually brought those.
Yeah, they're fabulous. And then Like Water for Chocolate with Laura Esquivel. So those are my favorites.
That's a great collection.
Great. Good suggestions. Oh, I was trying to jot those down really fast. Marcia, thanks for that. We appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
866-999-4626 is our number if you would also like to add to our list of books on food. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I think, Kelly, you're up next.
Yeah. So diving back into the kids' books, I brought three little board books that are written by Amy Wilson Sanger, who's a Woods Hole resident. I only brought three, but there are more. They're all little first books about food for kids. So I brought Yum Yum Dim Sum, first book of sushi, and Hola Jalapeno. And she has the illustrations she's done with paper and then real objects. They're sort of collages, and they're just beautiful, colorful. They really grab kids' attention. And the rhymes are really, really cute. Like in the sushi one, it says, I see takeout tekamaki, kappa maki, pack to go, tamaki style hand roll with uni urchin roe. And so it's kind of fun to read with kids to introduce them to different kinds of food. And helpfully, they have on the back, usually, a pronunciation guide.
Oh, that's helpful.
Because, you know, kids don't know, but, you know, and then it will have a little description of what some of the foods are so that we can know what we're talking about.
Those are really cute.
Yeah.
Well, and I had an obligation, I felt, to bring this one book. And it's a great book. But many of you may already have read it and know it. It's Cod by Mark Kurlansky. He has done a number of these micro histories. This one is a biography of the fish that changed the world. He also did the book Salt. And he mentions Cape Cod, of course, in the course of writing about cod. And he writes, but ideas are not easily conquered by facts. And 78 years later, Bartholomew Gosnold was still looking for the passage to Asia. In 1602, Gosnold sailed beyond Nova Scotia, following the coast south to New England in search of a passage to Asia, where he intended to gather sassafras, which was highly prized because it was thought to cure syphilis.
Oh, my.
North America abounds in sassafras. The Native Americans used the leaves to thicken soups. It never cured syphilis, but the roots made an excellent drink later known as root beer. Gosnold did not find China, but he returned to England with sassafras. The powder of the sassafras, reported one of his officers, cured one of our company that had taken a great surfeit by eating the bellies of dogfish, a very delicious meat. And he goes on to then talk about Smith in 1616, who published his map and a description of New England. And studying the famous captain's map, the pilgrims decided to ask England for a land grant to North Virginia, where there was this Cape Cod. Bradford wrote, quote, the major part inclined to go to Plymouth, chiefly for the hope of present profit to be made by the fish that was found in that country. When the British court asked them what profitable activity they could engage in with a land grant, they said fishing. So really, it's now, I think, a classic of his. But what I did not know about Mark Kurlansky is he also wrote fiction. Mm-hmm. And so he also wrote a novel called Boogaloo on Second Avenue, a novel of pastry, guilt, and music, which apparently was a bestseller when it came out. And it is, here's a little description from the New York Times. Boogaloo, Second Avenue, loose and jangly, Kurlansky's novel is a joyful celebration of a New York neighborhood in the late 1980s, a time when Daryl Strawberry was hitting, Michael Dukakis had not yet climbed into the tank, and East Village residents could almost ignore the encroaching signs of gentrification. Against this backdrop, Nathan Seltzer, Kurlansky's mid-30s married hero, contemplates selling his copy shop and has an affair with a pastry maker. The neighborhood's lively mixture of cultures and languages, English, Spanish, Italian, Yiddish, and German, pulls him in many directions, encompassing everything from Caribbean black magic to Eastern European minyans. And he was originally, which I also did not know, a columnist for Food and Wine magazine. And the reviewer writes, Kurlansky knows how to make food sexy and sex foodie, especially in the scene where Nathan's lover teaches him to make chocolate buttercream frosting. So this is called Boogaloo on Second Avenue by Mark Kurlansky.
Oh, thanks for that. All right. Jane is calling from East Ham. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I had my first cookbook when I was 3, and I cannot resist cookbooks, and it is a problem. My latest, though, is Deb Perlman's book.
Oh, yeah.
Smitten Kitchen book.
Smitten Kitchen.
And her new one is really terrific and has introduced us to a couple of new things that we never, had before. And also Ruth Reichel.
Oh, right. Ruth, yes.
Restaurant. Her books are funny because her mother was strange.
Jane, what's Deb's new cookbook called?
It's called Every Day, Smitten Kitchen Every Day.
Okay, Smitten Kitchen. Good, great.
And it's in the library system. I'm asking it for gifts for Christmas. What does a grandmother need anymore? Once in a while, giving in.
Yeah, her website, Smitten Kitchen, is fabulous as well. There are so many recipes on there, and usually not a week goes by that I don't make at least one dinner from her website.
Yeah. That's a fun thing about cookbooks, and you mentioned this, Jane, that you found some things that you recipes that you maybe wouldn't have tried otherwise, right?
Well, ingredients, halloumi cheese, I had never heard of that. And it's it's very interesting. Goat cheese from Cyprus, and it's seasonal. And we really have enjoyed it in the summer. But yes, it's just fun. I can't resist the new cookbook stuff. Yeah. My children are just as bad as I am, so that's the way we go.
All right.
thank
well,
you for this.
Thank
this
you. Yes, thanks for the suggestions. We'll add that to our list, and of course, we will have a link a little bit later, because Jill's going to go put this list together after the show, and then we'll have it on our website, capeandislands.org, a little later today. Mary Ann is calling from Brewster. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
It's a wonderful program. Thank you for having it.
Sure.
One of my all-time favorite books and movies is Babette's Feast.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
And it just romanticizes the food I just find it to be absolutely wonderful to be able to sharing the experience of food with other people, and it just glorifies that.
Mm-hmm. Called Babette's Feast. Okay, great. Thanks, Marianne. Thanks for adding that to our list. Jill, you're frantically
looking. I think, in fact, one of these books has the short story. I don't know which one, but it's actually based on a short story. The film is, but the film is beautiful. The film was absolutely fabulous.
All right, Kelly.
Well, speaking of, getting introduced to new ingredients and such, this would be a helpful book to have on your shelf. It's called On Food and Cooking: The Science and Lore of the Kitchen by Harold McGee. This particular edition that I brought is completely revised and updated. I'm not sure when the first one came out, but we had an old tattered paperback copy on our shelf for a very long time. But it's wonderful because you can look up any ingredient and find out what it is, how to store it, where it comes from, and then he also goes into a lot of science about various, you might want to know, like, why do I need to scald milk, or what would this be doing, to the molecular structure, and he goes into all of it. And it's great because you can dip in and look up just what you want to find out, or if you're like my husband, you can sit and read it cover to cover and become encyclopedic about all things food. And it's just really, really great. It's called On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee.
All right.
Well, and I will just mention that Babette's Feast, it was Isaac Dinesen who wrote the short story Babette's Feast that then was turned into a full-length film.
Mm. I hadn't heard of it before.
Oh,
yeah.
It's
I'll have to check it out.
Definitely. And I brought another book, which again is a book about books, of which there are so many. And this one is called Voracious: A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. And this is based on a blog, and she has it broken up by how old she was. So the first section is childhood, then adolescence, then adulthood. And I have to say, absolutely Hansel and Gretel, one of the scariest stories ever, right? But she also has Nancy Drew in here, and she talks about all of these books and has then recipes to go with them. But may I say, the adolescent and college years are a little dark. Lord of the Flies, Moby Dick, Clam Chowder, and Les Miserables, Black Rye Bread. It's not all happy cooking here. But she also has a great little section on Rebecca, the novel by Daphne du Maurier, which I would not have thought of as a book about food until I read this. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess there is more than I thought. And she writes, Rebecca is brimming with mouthwatering food. The breakfasts at Manderley, the De Winter Estate, are awe-inspiring, particularly to our narrator, who is used to so much less. There are scrambled eggs and bacon, fish, boiled eggs, porridge and ham. There is an entire table of condiments for the toast and scones, jam, marmalade, and honey, as well as dessert dishes and mountains of fresh fruit. The foods are simple and comforting, but the sheer amount leaves the narrator wondering, after Maxim takes only a small piece of fish from this bounty, what happens to all the food that goes untouched? And she then goes on to do a recipe for blood orange marmalade. So each novel, she talks a little bit about how food is involved, and then she gives you a recipe. It's really very fun, and it is called Voracious: A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books.
And there's a recipe for blood orange marmalade. I want to check that out. I
yes,
love orange
there is.
Marmalade.
Well, this
right.
is the book
okay,
for you.
This is the book for me. Kelly.
So another cookbook that I brought is called Whole Grains for a New Generation by Leanna Krissoff. And I really enjoy this because I like to do a lot with whole grains. I participate in a grain CSA.
Do you? Wow.
Once a year, you trek up to just outside of Boston and pick up 75 pounds plus of whole grains.
What do you do with 75 pounds of whole grains, Kelly?
I eat them. I have a little mill that goes right on my KitchenAid, so I bake with it. But then you can also, like this book points out, make grain salads. You can, you know, you can use just all sorts of different ways. There's shrimp and quinoa spring rolls. All sorts of wonderful things that are just outside of what you might normally think of, like whole grain, just, you know, gritty, kind of bitter stuff. So it gives you a lot of great ideas.
All right, Kelly, I got to go back to this. So you get 75 pounds of, like, what kind of, just, is it all the same type of grain?
No, so you can, it's called the Pioneer Valley Heritage Grain CSA, and you can choose, so you get regular wheat, you can get buckwheat, let's see, what else did I get? Spelt, rye, beans, oats, dried corn for making, you can make hominy and tortillas.
Do the kids help you with this?
They do,
I was
going to
say, because, you know, when kids can get involved in the preparing or cooking and seeing where the food comes from, they get very excited.
Absolutely. Yeah. And actually a really fun thing that I've done with the corn, I'm adding a tortilla press to the Woods Hole Library's Library of Things. Oh. So you can check it out from the library and then you can make your own tacos and tortillas. And that's really, really fun to do with kids.
Yeah.
And there are some ideas for things like that in this book. Whole grains for a new generation.
All right. I know you brought Allie's book. So yeah,
right.
Talk about that.
I did want to mention Allie Burlow's book with a foreword by Alice Randall called The Food Activist Handbook, Big and Small Things You Can Do to Help Provide Fresh, Healthy Food for Your Community. And what she writes in the intro is, you will not find in this book equations to determine the perfect size for a school garden or the exact number of shovels, hoes, and rakes it takes to build one. There's no single blueprint that a town or city can download when it builds its urban gardens, aquaponic greenhouses, or vertical farms. But among these pages, you will find resources that will allow you to dig deeper. And she starts with this list, and it's a list of lots and lots of words. For example, the word wage, peace, grow food, turn guns into farm tools, or be outspoken, take action. No one else can do it for you. It's a whole series of things, that suggestions of things that you can do. And she also has a section in here on another thing you could do is hold a poetry workshop. Now, who would think holding a poetry workshop would be the thing to do for a food activist? But she says, at Edible Vineyard, we sponsored local farmers to attend a poetry workshop and write about their livestock, especially chickens. This event was initiated by local poet Samantha Barrow and was another kind of offshoot from the Humane Mobile Poultry Processing Trailer that rolls through our farming community. So it has got all kinds of ideas.
That poultry, mobile poultry thing, is amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, I mean,
have you seen this?
Yeah, I have seen it. Yeah, it's amazing. Well, and, you know, you think when you're slaughtering chickens and things, it's not smelly. It's very humane. It's amazing. Yeah.
So this is called The Food Activist Handbook. Lots of ideas for how you can be a food activist in your community. Things like supporting a local grocery store, start a food miles labeling program, campaign to raise the minimum wage. I mean, it's all over the place. Start a campaign to tax unhealthy food. Mm-hmm. She has lots and lots of ideas in here. And you starts with very small things to sort of big, big things. Mm-hmm. And I think it looks like a fabulous book. And it, as she says, our food system has reached a crisis point and we need to make it healthy again.
Right.
And that's her.
And lots of ideas, but even if you do one or two, it's something, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And she talks about a lot of things that are happening in other places, whether throughout New England. So a really fabulous book, The Food Activist Handbook.
I have to plug Allie Burlow, one of our local food reporters.
Right.
So you can hear Allie when her reports here on WCAI. And you can check out a list of all the books we talked about a little bit later today up on our website, capeandislands.org. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Kelly Porter, librarian at the Woods Hole Public Library. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.